Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Today, we are going to talk about Afghanistan. And to be straight up with you, this is a tough one. Many of us sitting around this table have served in the theater. We've worked on the war from a policy vantage, and we have known people who have paid the ultimate sacrifice in what eventually became America's longest war. Now, to see the images of the collapse over the past few weeks have been plainly, exceedingly difficult to see. And I think it's fair to say that all of us at Mitchell have felt what most Americans have felt: sadness, disappointment, anger, and frustration. And because of this emotion, we decided to continue with our existing production schedule in the immediate wake of the mass evacuation so that we could gather some insight and perspective. The last thing we wanted to be was one more reactionary voice stampeding on the microphone. But it's important to look at what happened from a strategic perspective and add some thoughtful insight. And that's what we're going to do here today. Now, normally we post the rendezvous roundtables during the first week of every month, but given all the gravity, we decided to press ahead and bring the team together for this conversation. And as we kick this off, I want to be crystal clear at how we at Mitchell will always approach this conflict. You may hear us be critical at the strategic level regarding the range of decisions and question operational concepts, but you will never hear us question the bravery and dedication to duty at the individual and unit level. The folks who put themselves in harm's way did what was asked of them, and they did more above and beyond the call of duty. We will always owe them a debt of gratitude. And this is really an important nuance because strategic assessments are hard and things clearly did not go well here, and there's a lot that must be learned. But dedication to duty and personal bravery in the face of incredibly difficult circumstances was not one of the shortcomings. So when you hear us roll in with some pointed critiques, our entire motivation is to ensure that we don't make these sort of mistakes again. We can't afford it as a nation given what's at stake these days, and we certainly should never put young Americans in harm's way, asking them to solve the unsolvable. That's what leadership is for, to make those calls, and that's where we think the greatest reforms need to occur. So with that, let's turn it over to our team. This week, we've got General David Deptula, the Dean of the Mitchell Institute, Senior Fellow Heather Penny, Doug Berkey, who is our Executive Director, and Senior Analyst Daniel Rice, who is also our very own producer of the Aerospace Advantage podcast. General Deptula, let's begin with you, and let's scope this discussion by going back to the original mission objectives. And you were one of the leaders who kicked off Operation Enduring Freedom in the immediate wake of 9/11. So what was the immediate scope of the assigned mission at the time?
Well, Slick, let me put this in context a bit. I was in my office in the Pentagon when one of the 9/11 attackers flew a 767 into the Pentagon just two quarters away. Needless to say, I rounded up the people in my directorate, and we got out of there. Just a few days later, the new Air Force Chief of Staff, General John Jumper, who had only been on the job for about a week, asked me to come down to his office. And it was at that time that Jumper told me that Lieutenant General Chuck Wald, then the CENTCOM Joint Force Air and Space Component Commander, had asked for me to come to Saudi Arabia to command the Combined Air and Space Operations Center at Prince Sultan Air Base. Now, the KAOC had only been recently completed when General Wald wanted me to plan and work on with him on executing the attack on Al-Qaeda and the Taliban harboring them. So within a few days, I find myself on a way again to the Persian Gulf 10 years after I was involved in planning and executing the Fulse Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm. And so I found myself engaged in frantic efforts to organize the staff, get the new KAOC operating, and developing the war plans for America's response to the 9/11 attacks. I could talk about details of this for hours, but in the interest of time, the bottom line is we put together an innovative use of air power in conjunction with a light footprint of special operations folks, both of which partnered with the Afghan Northern Alliance in the opening stages of what became Operation Enduring Freedom. And what we did was we accomplished in a matter of weeks what the previous 5 years of indigenous ground force operations could not. And that was the removal of the Taliban regime. Now, that was one of three critical objectives directly affecting U.S. security. The other two involve supporting a new government protecting the people of Afghanistan. And the third was eliminating the al-Qaeda terrorist training camps in Afghanistan. So in 3 short months, these objectives were all achieved. The trillion-dollar question here, literally, is why did the United States and our coalition partners not declare victory then and there? In retrospect, what we should have done is said, hey, see you later, have a nice life, but if you do it again, we'll be back. Instead, the U.S.-led coalition poured hundreds of thousands of ground forces into Afghanistan over the next 2 decades after these vital security objectives were realized. We had accomplished these objectives so fast that Central Command had not even finished the planning for the deployment of what they called the decisive phase of traditional joint force operations, which is nothing more than a euphemism for tens of thousands of boots on the ground. More on that later, but let me stop here for now. I think that gets to the heart of your question.
Well, sir, thank you for recounting that. I know all of us, including our listeners, will probably remember where they were on the morning of 9/11. And to hear your perspective is really sobering for me. The next question I have for you, sir, is what about the rules of engagement and joint execution at this time? Because I know a lot of us, including our listeners, have thought about this quite a bit.
Yeah, the rules of engagement during the opening stages of enduring freedom were absolutely onerous, completely the opposite of the way they were in Operation Desert Storm. In Afghanistan, no bomb, not a single one, could be dropped anywhere without Central Command senior level approval. Now, to put it in context for the significance of these constraints, let me offer a dramatic example that occurred on the opening night of Enduring Freedom. Now, intelligence folks had picked up the location of Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, and his senior advisors. And we had a Predator UAV operated by the Central Intelligence Agency. It was the first Predator equipped with Hellfire missiles, able to track the Taliban convoy to a complex of buildings southwest of Kandahar, about 13 kilometers, if I'm not mistaken. Now, given the potential value of this target, I put 2 fighters equipped with JDAMs, Joint Direct Attack Munitions, on station 20 miles away, because we wanted to minimize the potential for jet noise, to attack once we got authorization. Now, this is like 2:30, 3 a.m. in the morning, too, so, you know, we're sensitive to the noise issue. I urged General Wald, the Joint Force Air Component Commander at the time, to get permission from General Franks to strike the building where the senior group was located. And we watched the real-time Predator feed in the chaos of what was going on around those buildings. They'd all, you know, we watched the whole train of these folks in a couple of trucks, both go down and unload into one building. So we knew exactly where they were. But time ticked on. Permission had to come from Franks. And as I found out afterwards, the delay came from a concern in headquarters over potential collateral damage from the 1,000-pound JDAM to a nearby adobe mud hut. And you know, as we're preparing and want this lucrative target to take out the first night, suddenly, without authorization from anyone in the theater command chain, the Predator fired a Hellfire missile. The small warhead had little chance of doing any serious damage, and instead, what happened was it just scared everyone out of the building, and they scattered to the four winds. Apparently, The CIA had ordered the strike due to frustration with the delay from the commander of Central Command. I think I mentioned this, but this was the very first use of a weapon from a UAV in conflict. The Taliban leadership fled the scene. Mullah Omar was never caught, and he died 12 years later from tuberculosis. And although Wald was a Joint Force Air Component commander, he had not authorized the strike. So there are two major observations from this problematic operation. First, command relationships among the various U.S. government organizations involved should have been established prior to operations with the supported component commander, Joint Force Air Component commander in this case, having weapons release authority. Second, concerns over collateral damage should have been weighed against the strategic value of the target. Eliminating Omar and the Taliban leadership on the opening night of the war would have been a huge strategic victory and a devastating blow to the Taliban, something made possible by America's technological advantage. But superior U.S. capabilities were negated by the decision not to authorize weapons release because of fears of collateral damage. Just an absolute incredible example of letting collateral damage overweigh strategic judgment.
Well, Heather, I know that you flew in Iraq as well, and just transition into your idea on the crippling rules of engagement.
Well, what General Deptula said regarding the very restrictive rules of engagement were something that we all had to suffer through in Iraq as well. Now, I'd never flew in Afghanistan, but I flew in Iraq with similar counterinsurgency operations. And any single strike really had to be authorized from the KAOC. So there was mother may I involved with every single action that we took. And so it was very frustrating because that time was so valuable in terms of whether or not we were going to be able to get the bad guys or let them go so they could fight another day. That really caused a lot of, it just really induced friction into our own operations. So in many ways, those rules of engagement were our own worst enemies. And in some ways, those rules of engagement were also then exploited by the bad guys because they then understood not only the time and the considerations and collateral damage, they would then set up the battlefield scene such that we had to deal with those collateral damage problems. So, you know, it's like, I know you flew in Afghanistan. What was your experience like?
Well, very, very much the same thing. I mean, both Iraq and Afghanistan, and I did fly in both. And I can't really say one was worse than the other because they were both just really bad in the sense of what General Deptula and you both described with this mother may I type of scenario. It was so reflective to what I had studied about Vietnam and having, you know, the proverbial White House and other leaders directing the war, you know, from Washington versus amongst the strategic, operational, and tactical leadership of trained warfighters that they had in theater. So, of course, there were many times, and I know we could sit around and tell war stories, and maybe we will one day, about opportunities to take out leadership that we had been watching and spent hours gathering intel on, but we just never got that cleared hot from the voice over the radio that we were waiting on. So had the very same experience, Heather.
Yeah. And again, not only did the adversaries, did the bad guys know and then exploit those rules of engagement, but it was so frustrating and demoralizing, not just to us in the air, but I have to imagine those on the ground as well as friendly nationals, right? Whether or not they're Iraqis or Afghanis, because they knew they could see the bad guys getting away and living to fight another day.
Right. Well, General Deptula, now you've got to recage us, and I've got to ask the question of how did we go from a focused campaign in response to the attacks on 9/11 into America's longest war, you know, being defined by a mass ground operation and a nation building effort?
Well, it's a great question. And unfortunately, it's a pretty simple answer. Neutering al-Qaeda and eliminating Afghanistan as an al-Qaeda sanctuary were critical U.S. national security objectives. But attempting to turn Afghanistan into a modern Jeffersonian democracy was not. Pure and simple. Now, critics may insist that early 2002 was too soon to realize that al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was indeed neutered. But when we shifted from a strategy of counterterrorism to one of counterinsurgency, we shifted from a set of strategic objectives that were vital to the U.S. to a new set of objectives that were not. After large numbers of U.S. and coalition ground forces got in place, they found that the Taliban were out of power, al-Qaeda in Afghanistan were neutered, and a friendly government was in power. So they looked around for a mission. And what did they come up with? Winning hearts and minds. Now, this shift occurred gradually and without fanfare, except for the publicly celebrated surges of additional ground forces, resulting in a serious case of mission creep. We evolved from a mission of unquestionable security rationale into one that was not ours to solve, that being the transfiguration of the tribal peoples of Afghanistan into citizens of a modern nation state. Unfortunately, this mission creep will not be easy to admit, particularly in the Pentagon. But it's necessary to recognize if we're going to avoid similar outcomes in the future. It also highlights the failure of the ground-centric nation-building via a land occupation strategy that was embraced by U.S. Central Command and by a U.S. joint staff that's been dominated by land warfare officers who did not learn or relearn the lessons of Vietnam. I do want to emphasize here that at a tactical level, the efforts of the military men and women who fought in Afghanistan were a success in every way. The same was not the case when assessing U.S. operations in Afghanistan from a strategic perspective. The large-scale ground occupation efforts that marked the past two decades in Afghanistan were simply a failure of strategy.
Well, Doug, I'd like to shift to you, and sir, thanks for clarifying that. But Doug, I understand you were on the Hill during this period, and what is your take on all of this from a congressional oversight perspective?
Now, Slick, I appreciate the question, and I think it's important from an oversight perspective, because if you look at Afghanistan and in many ways Iraq, retrospectively, it's a slow-motion car crash that took years and years to unfold. So Congress's one of the number one jobs is oversight. So how did this happen? And being there at the time, there was tremendous momentum coming after 9/11. People wanted results. They wanted decisive action. So there was tremendous leeway given to the military. And there was also an element in play where there are very few members with military experience. And so the first person, insight, understanding of military strategy, operational concepts, tactics, culture, you name it, there wasn't that familiarity that you might have had in earlier generations. For example, members that had served in World War II and all, to push back and feel comfortable pushing back and having that personal authority to do so. And so very long leash was given to the services. And there are times really it shouldn't have been. And you could look at something like the Tora Bora example, where there was tremendous disastrous planning, huge problems, and there should have been an oversight investigation of how that went down, because it set a pattern of failures that continue to happen throughout the conflict for decades, where there wasn't true joint perspective and skill sets brought into the equation. It was very land-centric planning and you know, hey, if we're not going to, if we think it's ridiculous to put a fighter pilot in charge of a tank, then why do we think it's okay to do that effectively at a senior level, having land commanders run air campaigns and all that? You know, it takes decades to build this kind of experience. The real wake up on the Hill came actually from Iraq, but it was driven over to Afghanistan, how people looked at things. Two real things. Number one, WMDs not being found. And then the Abu Ghraib prison disaster. Both of those really woke people up. But in many ways, a lot of these challenges were already baked in. And like I said, that culture of aggressive oversight, I think, was lacking at times, and we paid for it.
Well, thanks, Doug. I appreciate that. And, you know, essentially we all have lived through this war for two decades, and there didn't seem to be a lot of thinking about alternate ways to achieve strategic objectives. We were occupying, so we just kept occupying. And it didn't seem like folks were really focused on securing a desired effect. They were just focused on following the means that that were in front of them. So to this point, I think it's fair to point out that a parallel air campaign was being executed in Pakistan next door to manage the terrorist threat. And does that point to a notion of a different path we could have pursued? And Doug, we'll start with you on this one.
Yeah, I think, you know, and we've hit upon this gently in different ways, but this whole notion of jointness, the entire reason why you want different perspectives from around the table, whether it be sea, air, land, space, et cetera, is to really look at different ways in which you can solve a problem. But early on, the land component was fundamentally given the keys to this war, and they held them till the end. And so every solution set fundamentally became very similar, and it was more of a scale. Did you want the small, medium, or large option of it? But to actually break the mold and think, what is the actual fundamental effect we want to achieve, and then how do we engineer our way there in the most effective, efficient way? Those options were cut out just because there wasn't the diversity of thought. And this is something that is crucial as we look at the challenges facing us with China, Russia, North Korea, Iran. We cannot be wedded to a means. We have got to be wedded to what is the most effective, efficient, decisive way of getting the job done, because the adversary is not going to allow us the leeway of paying attention to bureaucratic prerogative over fighting and winning decisively.
I just want to throw in real quick here, to go back to the point that I was making about that we had accomplished our objective so quick that that Central Command hadn't even finished the established joint doctrine phase three of the four-phased approach. You know, there was preparation, there was deployment, there was decisive phase, and then there was the cleanup, if you will. And it just reemphasizes Doug's point. We have to change that mindset and get to the issue of using the right force at the right place at the right time, not adhering to dogma that, quite frankly, was developed in the early and mid segments of the last century.
And let me jump in with it's kind of a one-liner, but I think it's true. There was a book that came out at the beginning of the war called Eating Soup with a Knife. And obviously it speaks to the difficulty of counterinsurgency warfare. Well, I got to say, if you're eating soup with a knife 20 years later, guess what? That's insane. Go buy a spoon. So if you're seeing that the gains you need are not being realized in a rationally realistic fashion, you got to shake things up. And that just never happened. We kept just rolling along because we were in a rut.
Yeah. Well, thinking back, and I mentioned it, you know, I was in IFF getting ready to go start flying the F-16 when 9/11 happened. And, you know, my thought process was during F-16 school, you know, hey, I'm going to miss this war. It's going to be done and over before I'm mission capable. And obviously things kept rolling on. And that's where, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this Vietnam mindset came in with a no objective. You know, what does mission success mean? How do we define that? And, you know, as we know now, most folks in uniform joined after 9/11. So their new normal is this type of thinking, this hijacked notion of jointness because of the two decades of occupation that's done to our military as a whole. So I'd like to start with General Daptula to talk us through this.
Yes, Slick. I just kind of alluded to the fact that the joint doctrine that had been developed since the Goldwater-Nichols Act that established this whole focus on joint operations has really become dogma. You know, I talked about sort of these prescripted phases and, you know, the ground components turned decisive phase into boots on the ground. And by the way, it's not just the military folks, it's also the national security leadership, National Security Council inside the White House, that for 20 years have equated strategy with the numbers of boots on the ground. That's simply not the case. You know, Doug talked about it, he alluded to it. I mean, in some of the discussions I remember back in 2007, 2009, And then later in Afghanistan in the 13-14 time frame, you know, option A was 25,000 troops. Option B was 35,000 troops. And option C was 45,000 troops. That's ridiculous. That's why there needs to be a focus on outcomes, desired outcomes and end states. And we've got to get away from this notion that land forces are absolutely required to meet our security objectives, because they're not. The beauty of the joint construct is that a joint task force commander has at his or her option a variety of capabilities that are provided by the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and now space components. And he or she can select the right forces in the proper proportion to meet the needs of the contingency at hand. Unfortunately, too many people have been operating in this under this failed notion that jointness is the equivalent of Little League rules, where everybody gets to play. And that's not the case. In some cases, you're going to have a preponderance of force that are ground forces. And there's no denying that that was the case in Iraq and Afghanistan. But in other instances, you look at tsunami relief, Operation Unified Assistance, there were hardly any Army forces. There were mainly, it was principally an airlift operation with some sea forces involved. So we have to adapt to the situation. And my God, one of the most horrible things that has become embedded in the Pentagon recently over the last just 2 or 3 years is people talk about the joint force with a capital J and a capital F. There is no such thing as a capital J, capital F joint force. It's an oxymoron. We need the separateness of the services to capitalize on those capabilities, but they need to be applied relative to the contingency at hand, and every contingency is going to be different. I hope that clarifies the point.
Well, sir, just to jump on, look at Operation Inherent Resolve, the air war over Syria, commanded by a ground leader, and nobody even thought twice about it. That's insane.
Yeah, well, we could do a whole series on that, and I think we ought to. But yeah, that's another one. It goes back to your point, Doug, where no one has any problem putting an armor corps commander in charge of an air campaign. But, you know, they wouldn't think about putting an armor division commander in charge of a carrier battle group. Why would you think that putting ground officers in charge of an air campaign are a good idea?
Yes, sir. I couldn't agree with you more. I know from my perspective, air power obviously could have been leveraged a whole lot better in Afghanistan and, of course, Iraq as well. But I really want to transition to one of the big topics at hand, and we really need to talk about what everybody's thoughts are on the way this is wound down in Afghanistan. So, General Deptula, we'll get started with you.
Well, let me reemphasize prior to my remarks that the efforts of the men and women who fought in Afghanistan were a success in every way. They were doing and they executed very well what they were told to do. However, getting to recent events, there was a serious case of either misplanning or lack of foresight in planning by the current administration's national security leadership. Because what is happening now in Kabul is no surprise to those of us familiar with the Taliban, the former Afghan military, and the political situation. If a complete U.S. military exit was the goal, then the U.S. citizens in country and key Afghanistan personnel at risk by the Taliban should have been evacuated well prior to the final U.S. military departure, not simultaneously with it.
Heather, hop in on this one.
How this has gone down not only indicates a total failure of planning. I mean, this is the DOD, right? We have operational plans for every kind of contingency. There should have been at least 17 different types of plans for exiting Afghanistan that were up on the shelf gathering dust. And so when the time came that we did that, you'd pull down one plan, blow the dust off, see what the context is and says, if this, then that. Nope, not this plan. Go on to the next one. If this, yeah, this is the plan we're going to use. So the fact that there was not an established operational plan and exit in an orderly manner, like what General Deptula said, it is absolutely irresponsible. And I am surprised that we are not seeing senior leaders being held accountable for this. We also can't ignore the impact that this is having on currently serving service members, veterans, and future Americans that are considering serving our nation. You know, in many ways, having boots on the ground for this long-term occupation provided a continuing fodder, almost empowering the Taliban, because if we hadn't been there, they wouldn't have had an adversary to fight. And so it gave them a continuous motivation and trained them over the course of 20 years in our operations in the way that we had trained the Afghan military as well. At the same time, I don't think that we can ignore the positive and hopefully lasting impact that the individual service members had on the lives of those that they touched when they were on the ground. I mean, if you think about it, you've had 20 years where Americans and our coalition partners have created the space for young girls to go to school, for Afghan women to begin continuing their education and becoming, involved in the economy, having jobs, exercising their expertise. So they've experienced a different alternative to life than what they will now see imposed upon them from the Taliban. So if we see, the record is not written yet on what the long-term outcome of the last 20 years has been, because we're, like I said, we're not going to see that for perhaps a decade or even longer. But if it's positive, I'll tell you that that's because of the individual actions of individual Americans and coalition partners on the ground, not because of the strategy.
Sure. Now, both General Deptula and Heather brought up a point that I want to ask Doug. And of course, sticking to the on-the-shelf plans that we have experts thinking about the impossible and coming up with a plan every day. So, Doug, do you think that potentially there could have been a military plan that was just ignored by elected leaders in Washington?
Yeah, I find it utterly puzzling. I think, from my personal perspective, I don't disagree with the decision to disengage. I'm not sure how you could look at an American, set of parents and say, hey, your kid's life is worth it at this stage of where we were. But the operational execution is cataclysmic. And I think, whether it's looking at why weren't we destroying supply depots, why weren't we handling the military evacuation better, why did we surrender the largest secure air base we had and then have to retreat to Kabul, which is incredibly difficult. I mean, the list goes on. And I think the images of this chaotic withdrawal are going to be with us for an awfully long time. And it is cataclysmic. And remember, we've got an all-volunteer force, Slick. How are you going to justify to young Americans that they should join this team when this is how they see that their sacrifice and their lives are being wagered? It is disastrous. How are we going to look at allies? And, this is something that sells on the street. You just saw images of that C-17 getting mobbed. That's something that every citizen, whether it's in the UK, Germany, Japan, Taiwan, Australia, the list goes on, that they're responding to and they're saying, why should we ally with the United States? This is huge. And so it's an operational failure with strategic results that cannot be overstated. And I side with Heather on this. I do not know why people are not being held accountable on this. The impact is so severe, and there has got to be a cultural change here. This is a pass-the-buck culture for many years on this leadership. Guys came in for rotation. They went home. It was kind of a bureaucratic execution of a war. Lincoln fired his generals when they weren't performing. It might be time to go back to that a little bit.
Slick, I don't know about you, but on the BroNet, I'm hearing a lot of airmen and other service members just devastated by the way that Afghanistan has wound down, and given the life, the loves, and the limbs that they've sacrificed for the last 20 years. They're really questioning what the meaning of their service has been. And so, as Doug said, how we are leaving Afghanistan in the chaos and just the total lack of planning not only has severe, significant consequences for how we engage in global competition, it's also going to have severe consequences for our service members, their mental health, their retention, and future recruitment. There has been such a break of faith for service members. I mean, like, what are you hearing on the BroNet? Do you agree?
Well, you know, Heather, I do agree. And this is the third time I'm going to say Vietnam, but, you know, I meet regularly. It's something I personally enjoy with the former 4th Fighter Squadron commander in the latter part of Vietnam. He is a 5-tour combat veteran. Four combat tours in Vietnam, 500 plus missions, ranging from his CIA early days flying bird dogs doing FAC-A in the early 60s, all the way through the latter part of the 70s when he was the 4th Fighter Squadron commander in the F-4. And basically, to the way General Deptula said, his experience, and this is Colonel Bob Graham, retired, his experience was when they were doing the special ops in clandestine operations, essentially, they were making headway and they were influencing areas and getting the bad guys out. And once it turned into this full scale boots on the ground, no direction, no definition of what mission success looks like, you know, he's basically saying we're reliving history and, you know, the fall of Saigon, it looks just like Kabul. So I think we're almost, you know, going to be reliving that 40-year-old history again, and having to rebrand and remotivate our folks as far as what it is that we're doing, what our Air Force is doing. And I know that we're down a rabbit hole here, but we're going to have to relook at that history and see where the wheels came off the bus. And, you know, I know we have all had our conversations, but I point directly at the time where the Air Force was, you know, asked, you know, what are you guys doing? How come you're not all in? Because we didn't have boots on the ground, and people forgot that we never left because, you know, the northern and southern no-fly zones that we had been supporting, we had been deployed since essentially 1989 with Operation Desert Shield, and we never left. And then all of a sudden we had supply folks running around with M16s or M9s in a convoy. So I think, you know, just air power got usurped. We forgot all of the lessons from Desert Storm, from leveraging air power, and we just got sucked into another version of Vietnam. So that's what I'm hearing. That's the perspective from folks, and I think we're going to have to reevaluate the solid use of air power in the future. I do want to look towards the future and learn from this experience, especially in the events of the recent weeks, and what this means for our allies and our adversaries. And we have Daniel Rice with us today. And Dan, some quick background on Dan. He is our resident China expert at Mitchell. And Dan, really like to get your thoughts, especially on the adversary piece.
Yeah, thanks, Slick. So I've thought about this a lot, and there's quite a lot of bit of chatter on this right now on the web. What you're going to hear about in the next few weeks is people that know China, they're going to talk about stability. And for China, that means stability in Afghanistan, even if it's under Taliban rule. But fundamentally, this comes down to opportunity. And there's opportunity in multiple areas. First off, propaganda-wise, this is huge. China's been painting this thing as an, you know, allies and partners of the U.S. Look at what just happened. That's going to happen in the future. And now, you know, I would like to push back on that, but that is the actual narrative coming out of China. Obviously, when you look at things like Taiwan, it's a different situation. So while they're saying that, the reality is it might go down differently. But there's also other opportunities here. And one of the big ones is Afghanistan and China have a really interesting relationship. China has acknowledged the Taliban pretty much since the late 90s. And they've always said that the Taliban were going to be part of a solution politically in Afghanistan. And now, when the U.S. was, you know, more or less propping up the Afghan government that we put in place, China ran into a lot of roadblocks with them. And for those of you not aware, Afghanistan is one of the key areas for China's Belt and Road Initiative, right? So as China was trying to develop infrastructure for their Belt and Road Initiative, they ran into roadblocks with the Afghan government. Projects were put on pause, and they really didn't develop the things that they were hoping to. So when you look at the future in Afghanistan, the Taliban and the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, because their relations are a little bit warmer, there's a lot of opportunity for China to pursue the infrastructure that they were really hoping to earlier. And why is that important? It's really important because some of the projects that were in Afghanistan are now going to change ownership, right? So whereas the previous Afghan government was getting a cut of those projects, suddenly there needs to be a new owner of those projects, and that's going to become the Taliban. So when you're looking at a Taliban funded primarily by illicit activities, now you're going to see one that has legitimate infrastructure projects and an actual economic base to support its political objectives. So last little bit here is when you're looking at Russia and China, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which until this point has really just been a shadowy organization, there's finally an opportunity for it to become operational. And that's been an aspiration of both of those countries for quite some time. And actually, earlier this week, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Secretariat, they put out a statement saying that they are willing to work with the UN and under international law to ensure stability in Afghanistan. Now, the important caveat on that is that they'll provide stability as long as the Taliban commit to not exporting extremism, drugs, and a war-fighting culture. And that little piece there, that really speaks to Chinese concerns about instability in Afghanistan and extremism bleeding over their small border with China and fueling some of the issues that we see with Chinese Uyghurs in Xinjiang. Now, I don't expect this support to really come down to boots on the ground, but it certainly means that there could be some mechanisms developed or certain operational units developed to help provide that stability. So those are kind of like the big things in play here. There's a lot of more nuanced things, but fundamentally, this is a lot of opportunity, and it's actually giving China and Russia almost unfettered access to Central Asia because there's no longer a strong NATO presence. There's no longer U.S. bases that are going to provide that hard military power check to Russia and China's aspirations.
Well, Dan, you just really enlightened a lot of people, and it's pretty scary. And I know that we're going to have to circle back on a lot of what you've just discussed with us. So I appreciate that. But I want to go off of something that you said and ask around the room, how are our allies taking all of this? And Doug, we'll get started with you.
Well, I kind of said it before. I think there are two elements of it. At a senior leader perspective, there obviously are huge challenges with how this went down. They don't feel included, but I think it's more in the populace level. Those populations are going to remember how this went down, and they're going to remember the sacrifices over 20 years, but the chaos at the end, and it is going to be very hard to sell them again on cooperative engagement.
And, you know, Slick, I'll jump in as well. It's not simply about the chaos at the end, but it's the regression and the lost objectives. So 20 years essentially flushed down the toilet for what? So I think that is going to have a significant impact in their confidence in being willing to partner with the U.S. in the future.
Yeah, I mentioned the Taiwan piece a little bit earlier. One of the things that China is really driving is the narrative for Taiwan and saying that, hey, look, Taiwan, you're not ready to fight. So this is adding to that narrative, and it's really devastating because if they don't have the will to fight for themselves, which fortunately they're still showing that will, but as soon as that willpower erodes, then we're going to have a really big problem in cross-strait relations.
Well, and Dan, to add to that, it's not simply about the cross-strait relations with Taiwan. It's about China's growing hegemony in the entire across the entire Pacific. So if the if America is not a trustworthy partner to help check that kind of power, then where are what's going to happen with bandwagoning? Where are allies going to go?
Yeah, that's especially important in Southeast Asia and the Indo-Pacific writ large. Yes.
All right, last question. Let's go around the table here. If there's one piece of policy each of you would share with leadership in the wake of all of this, what would it be? And we'll start with Dan.
Sure. My policy would be just be aware of trading short-term objectives for longer strategic objectives. It's something we see happen a lot, and it's very difficult in our democratic system to really take that long view. But me, you know, somebody that looks at China all of the time, they always take that long view. So they have time to really put forward a strategy that will span generations. And so my policy recommendation would be, you know, take a really good hard look at what you're suggesting and what are the trade-offs that might happen when you're pursuing short-term objectives. And we see that in Afghanistan.
You know, so like I would say we cannot treat combat command as if it's a merit badge that you get on your way up to being an Eagle Scout. You know, leadership matters, and we need to ensure that we're selecting the right combat commanders to support the right strategy based off of the right domain and how we're going to achieve that. We need to measure it, and we need to hold leaders accountable.
Let me jump in on this accountability piece. I think Congress has got to wake up and really amp it up on the oversight piece. I think if we saw the investigations that came after Vietnam, they were crucial for setting the military up for success going into the future. Crucial, crucial reforms. And after 20 years of this, it's time for another relook in some vital areas.
Okay, well, let me wrap it up. So my one piece of advice to emphasize: the importance of the President of the United States clearly defining the critical U.S. security objectives and then acting rapidly and effectively with no more or less than the appropriate force necessary to achieve those objectives, period, dot. Because we've talked a lot today about the military. There are four presidents that are culpable in the result that we see today.
Yeah, well, this has been a tough conversation, but it's been a very important one, and thanks for tuning in. And obviously, this is an issue we'll be watching. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.